This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, state of emergency remains in racially tense Ferguson, Missouri. New government reforms approved in Iraq. Research seeks answers to bringing down the noise in the wilderness.
We're testing the idea that these things are coupled, that as the soundscape gets louder, wildlife suffers, but that also feeds back onto how much people get out of that experience, how much they value it.
A high-profile pair sing a new duet. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The Midwestern U.S. city of Ferguson, Missouri, remains under a state of emergency after a second night of violence Tuesday, marking the first anniversary of the shooting death of an unarmed black man by a white police officer. Teenager Michael Brown was killed during a street confrontation that brought national attention to complaints of police discrimination against African Americans in the United States. Police arrested about two dozen protesters in the St. Louis suburb after demonstrators pelted them with rocks and bottles in the latest unrest. VOA correspondent Kane Farabaugh is in Ferguson and spoke with International Edition's Michael Lippin about the situation there.
I think many of the people that are here are locals. One person we talked to, in fact, said that he was a friend of Michael Brown. He wasn't out there being antagonistic. He was out there simply to explain that there are still things to accomplish in achieving equality. And actually, a comment he made to me, which is quite profound, is that, you know, Michael Brown's death was the shot heard around the world. And that shot continues to reverberate. Now, there are obvious people who are trying to capitalize on the media attention focused on this issue. And so there is a criminal element in the crowd that is antagonizing the police. And many of the protesters state that these aren't the kind of protests they want. They want the protests to remain peaceful, and they are against anybody trying to capitalize on these protests to turn them into a violent interaction with the law enforcement that's gathered there.
Now, I understand that after you left the streets, there were sightings of white militiamen called the Oath Keepers. What do people think about them?
Well, I think anytime you introduce men with guns into a very tense situation, it creates unease on everybody's part. So I think there was a widespread objection to their presence, certainly by those that were gathered there to protest, because the way that they're dressed, the weapons that they're carrying, it makes it uncertain why they're there and what they're going to do. And the fact that they've got weapons leaves everybody nervous.
And given that you were also in Ferguson 1 year ago, what do you think has changed in the situation in that town from then until now?
For me, the clearest example of change is the way in which the police had managed this situation, or are managing this situation. When I was here, particularly after the announcement and the lack of an indictment against Officer Darren Wilson, who was involved in the shooting death of Michael Brown, it seemed as if the police were not prepared for the massive protest that broke out, which resulted in a lot of destruction, a lot of violence. You'd remember there was a lot of tear gas deployed. You know, people were injured. It was a chaotic scene. The protests here, at least in the second night, were much more organized. Police were also able to contain them much, much more, and they were promptly ready to deal with anybody that was not complying or moving out of line. And I think that, for me anyway, that was the most visible example. Though people I had talked to also said that the protesters are certainly more enlightened. They might actually be more empowered to protest and speak out about what they view as inequality. However, they would say that the police still don't understand them, that there's still a large gap between what they wish to achieve and where the relationship is between them and law enforcement officials.
VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Farabaugh speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Time now to check out what's trending on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to tell us what people are tweeting about in terms of the Ferguson protests. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. The best Twitter account to get up-to-date information on Ferguson is the St. Louis County Police Department's account. Its handle is at STL County PD. It shared about 20 tweets, including retweets, during the last 24 hours. Here's an example. It tweeted on Monday night, "Officers are being hit with rocks and bottles. We continue to support free speech, but agitators who ignore orders to disperse risk arrest." The police department is also on Periscope, which is a video streaming app, so you can watch what happens live in Ferguson there. It also shares footage from surveillance cameras in the area.
Oh, that's interesting. A lot to see as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
What about the trending hashtags related to all of this protest?
Ray, hashtag Black Lives Matter is a big one, with about 45,000 tweets using that hashtag during the last 24 hours. An even more widely used hashtag is hashtag Ferguson, with nearly 130,000 tweets using that hashtag in the same time frame. Hashtag Michael Brown was used in about 2,000 tweets. That hashtag is, of course, referring to the African-American teenager who got shot.
Gee, the presidential hopefuls are very much in the news lately.
Mm-hmm.
Anything about their reactions? Any tweets from the contenders?
Well, surprisingly, none. Even Bernie Sanders, who is quite vocal about racial issues, didn't tweet about the anniversary or the ongoing protest. As a side note, there's even hashtag BernieSoBlack, which refers to him marching with Martin Luther King Jr. and organizing a sit-in to protest segregation in the 60s.
Well, thank you very much, G. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Iraq's parliament unanimously approved Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi's proposed government reforms to tackle corruption and cut spending. The changes include elimination of the largely symbolic offices of three vice presidents and three deputy prime ministers. Mr. Abadi's plan also calls for ending party and sectarian quotas when choosing officials, reducing the number of bodyguards assigned to officials, and reopening corruption investigations. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with John Jenkins, executive director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies Bahrain office, about the sweeping political reforms and what they mean to the ethnic sectarian balance of the Iraqi government.
It surprised me that it went through so fast. The original distribution of vice president posts was to bring all the different communities together within a government and give them all a stake in its success. Originally, this was vice presidential, then it became a principle for the distribution of posts within the government itself. And we have the same distribution between the president, the speaker, and the prime minister. It looked similar to the Lebanese system. Abadi himself has not shown a willingness to take this sort of bold decision before, so he must think he has some sort of support for this. What gives me pause is the fact that Maliki himself has come out in favor. At the same time, the Supreme Court is busy eroding the powers of Parliament. So, and this is a time when sectarian divisions in Iraq are as serious as they've ever been.
Iraq's parliament voted unanimously in favor of approving al-Abadi's reform package. There are winners and losers in this proposition, yet we have a unanimous vote.
I think the protests about services or the lack of services are genuine. I mean, they're genuinely. I mean, these are protests we've seen before. They were suppressed by the Maliki government in 2010, 2011, and it led then, of course, to the clearing of the protest sites in Hawija and Ramadi and Fallujah, which led indirectly to the resurgence of Daesh, the Islamic State. So this is something we've seen before. It's genuine. There's a real problem with the heart of government. No politician in Iraq is going to want to be seen, I think, to be standing against popular protests, particularly when they're protests which are by Shia, not Sunni, as they mostly were in 2010. So maybe this is a protective stance by Iraqi politicians. The question arises, of course, is if this proceeds, what sort of government do you get at the end of it? And there is a question about the constitutionality, for example, of not having a single vice president. You might not want three, but you probably need one. Although this has happened faster than I thought it was going to do, I think there are still real issues ahead about how this ends.
How do you plan to rout the corruption that is essentially so embedded in the system that it is the system?
Good question. We've seen various ministers over the last 10 years leave their posts, leave Iraq, having made reportedly huge amounts of money without actually having delivered anything. And if you look at various indices on corruption, Iraq at the moment figures very highly as a country where corruption is rife.
John Jenkins, executive director of the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies in Bahrain, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Greece and its international creditors have agreed in principle on broad terms of a new 3-year bailout. Greece's parliament is expected to vote on the measure by Thursday, with Eurozone finance ministers potentially giving their support by Friday. International Edition Susan Yaki spoke with VOA Economics Desk reporter Ken Bredemeyer about how significant the deal is.
The Greek government, it's been a long fight to come to a new accord with its creditors, but they reached a $94 billion bailout agreement. It's not quite done yet. It has to be signed off on by its creditors, such as its neighbors in Europe, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. But they needed to do this soon because Greece always seems to be up against some kind of a deadline. This time it's August 20th when they have to pay more than $3 billion back to the European Central Bank.
So there are some critics of this pact. What are they saying?
Critics would be, to a large degree, internal in Greece. Members of the prime minister's Syriza ruling party who feel that he has turned on what he ran for election on, which was to do away with the austerity that this new agreement requires. Now, it appears, however, that there's not going to be enough opposition to the deal to kill it. It will pass with some Syriza support, as well as other Greek lawmakers from other parties.
And I remember when last time you visited us, you were saying some of the Greek people feel really put upon by all this.
Certainly that's the case. Austerity has a bad name in Greece at this point. It's even worse than that. Greece has gone through a tumultuous period and has had to previously impose lots of austerity measures. And this particular bailout requires even more tax increases, pension cuts, and cuts in government spending, which a lot of Greeks have depended on and feel because the earlier austerity didn't improve their lot much. They're saying, why should we endure more? But that's what this deal calls for.
Yeah. Perhaps you'll refresh our memories on what kind of situation in Greece has brought on the need for all these deals.
Greece has been in economic turmoil for 5 years now. This is the third bailout in that time. And if you put this one with the other two, it's now a total of $359 billion, which is a huge amount for a country the size of Greece. It's just 2% of the economy in the European Union, but is deeply in arrears, and it's going to be a long time before it can get itself cleared again. These bailouts, if you can think on it on a personal terms, it'd be like getting a new credit card to pay back old credit card debts,
yeah.
If people can look at it from their own personal lives. And that's why it's a very difficult sort of situation for the Greeks.
Ken Breedemeyer of the VOA Economics Desk, talking with International Edition's Susan Yockey. China took a major step to revive its sluggish economy on Tuesday with the decision to weaken the value of its currency, the yuan. Alexis Christophers, our business correspondent in New York, is following developments, which has implications for economies around the world.
Well, this was certainly a surprise move by China. It devalued the yuan by 2%. That's the most we've seen in two decades. And this came after data showed a plunge in exports and weaker than estimated manufacturing. Now, the People's Bank of China called this change a one-time adjustment that it says will better align its currency with supply and demand. But still, it sparked concern throughout the global markets that the world's second largest economy is headed for a deeper slowdown and that perhaps other countries will do the same thing with their currency. We saw the news especially pressure companies that rely heavily on exports to China, like the automakers, like luxury good makers, and also Apple stock. I mean, that was one of the big losers on the day. It lost 5% because of its large exposure to China. Commodity producers, Freeport-McMoRan, Dow Chemical, also falling over concerns about China's growth. And, you know, something else here that could be at play is that China may be looking for a way to convince the IMF to include the yuan in its special drawing rights currency basket, and it thought that devaluing the currency would make it more attractive. So we'll have to see if the IMF moves on that.
The devaluation of the yuan is also having an effect on the price of oil. Again, here is Christophorus.
It got weaker in the last session. It gave up another 3%, closing at $43.46 a barrel. Traders are worried that demand from China will slow and that a weaker yuan will really eat away at the buying power of Chinese consumers. China is the world's biggest consumer of energy and metals, and so we see crude sort of languishing now at this new five-month low.
Business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. Still to come, researchers making a lot of noise to find more quiet. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Soybean oil is one of the most widely consumed cooking oils. But new research from the University of California, Riverside suggests that a diet high in soybean oil causes more obesity than a diet high in fructose.
Most people think that one of the major contributors to the obesity epidemic is fructose.
But researcher Poonam Jotdeol says that in an experiment with mice, those mice on a high soybean oil diet gained twice as much weight as those that consumed the equivalent of fructose.
Soybean oil is found in almost all the processed foods.
The California researchers say that in addition to weight gain, the soybean oil consuming mice showed evidence of metabolic syndrome, a cluster of conditions that increase the risk of heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. If you are someone who doesn't like a lot of noise, then give this a listen. In southwestern Idaho this summer, biologists are purposefully making a racket to study the value of natural quiet. Solar-powered loudspeakers are blaring away in the sagebrush plains. A research team is testing how wildlife and humans respond to noise pollution. Tom Bonsi reports the findings could someday guide solutions to lessen our noisy footprint in the world.
It started with an invisible road.
So the Phantom Road was the first landscape-scale noise playback experiment that we conducted.
A half-kilometer-long string of outdoor loudspeakers in the Boise National Forest mimicked the sounds of passing cars. Boise State University professor Jesse Barber says the two-year experiment demonstrated road noise alone causes migratory birds to flee and fail to gain weight. Now comes the phantom natural gas field.
This study is replicating compressor station noise from natural gas extraction fields on a much larger scale than the Phantom Road. We have 6 noise sites and 6 control sites.
That sound is an irritating reality in oil and gas basins throughout the American West. Here, a half hour south of Boise, the simulation by loudspeaker blares virtually 24/7. The purpose is to examine an interactive cascade of effects from noise pollution, not just on birds now, but also insects, bats, plants, and people.
We're testing the idea that these things are coupled, that as the soundscape gets louder, wildlife suffers, but that also feeds back onto how much people get out of that experience, how much they value it, and thus how much they're willing to protect that same place.
A negative feedback loop of sorts. The research team recruited amateur bird watchers as study subjects.
We'll do 8 songs in the noise condition and 8 songs in the quiet.
Graduate student Mitch Levenhagen measured how much the artificial noise impaired the volunteer listener's ability to identify recorded bird songs.
All right, we're going to begin the next one right now.
Repeating the experiment without the background noise comes as a relief. Next year, Levenhagen and Barber will temporarily relocate to Northern California to survey visitors at Muir Woods National Monument and other parks about how they perceive noise. The study volunteers this day found the simulated compressor more disruptive than anticipated. Jim Lyons said it made them value quiet moments more.
I just think the whole thing has been ear-opening, shall we say, to be part of this. Very stimulating, very interesting, and getting to think a lot about it, I know, from now on.
For fellow volunteer Janice Engel, the natural soundscape matters a lot.
I moved out of the city to, I bought a little place in the country where I wanted it to be quiet. I greatly value that. It's hard to find those places more and more.
Engel moved to rural Marsing, Idaho.
There are lots of ways to mitigate sound, but it's a trade-off. There's always a cost, and it comes down to people's values. What do we value more?
One proven solution to cut noise pollution is to build sound walls or berms beside the road, but those can block views or animal migration. Lowering the speed limit can dramatically reduce sound levels too, but requires drivers to buy in. Generators can be muffled, but at extra cost. The National Park Service is funding some of the science in this field and exploring other options. Those include road resurfacing treatments, also establishing quiet zones where signs direct park visitors to silence cell phones and behave like they're in a library or church. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Boise, Idaho.
Charlie Puth first gained international fame through the internet and his YouTube videos. Then his song, See You Again, was number one for weeks. Now he's about to release his first album and joins Meghan Trainor on a new duet called Marvin Gaye. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA's Larry London talked about the song and about some health problems Meghan is having.
First, she had a hit duet with John Legend. Now Meghan Trainor is back with Charlie Puth, a tribute song, Marvin Gaye. Larry? Well, tell me about this song.
It's a great song, and it's actually Charlie Puth's first solo release from his upcoming album, which is called Some Type of Love. It's an EP that is his first album ever. He's been a social media phenom. Back in 2009, he started putting stuff on YouTube and got very, very popular that way. And now he's got his own record. Of course, you know him from the number one hit See You Again, which spent 12 weeks at number one from the film Furious 7. It was a duet with Wiz Khalifa featuring Charlie Puth. Now we've got Charlie Puth featuring Meghan Trainor with Marvin Gaye.
Let's Marvin Gaye and get it on. You got the healing that I want. Just like they say in the song. Until the dawn, let's Marvin Gaye and get it on. You
But if you want to hear Megan, I understand you might want to listen to this record because she's having some vocal problems again.
Yeah, again, this seems to be a reoccurring issue with a lot of different singers. She canceled a number of shows several months ago, resumed the tour. Unfortunately, as of today, she has postponed her tour again because of throat problems.
Now, is this going to require surgery, or do we know that yet?
Not known yet. It might. Like Sam Smith had a vocal hemorrhage on one of his vocal cords, and he underwent surgery and spent 2 months in rehab, so maybe Meghan Trainor will have to undergo the same situation. Who knows? A lot of these singers have throat problems. She's only 20, and her throat is not used to this kind of wear and tear because she's a songwriter, remember. That's how she came up through the ranks.
Yeah, she's not used to being in front of, you know, thousands of people putting on a show, because that can take its toll. I know that there's several high-profile country artists that Nikki Strong and I talked about who had the same problem. It's either a node or it's a like a callus on their vocal cords, or the blood vessels rupture, like Sam Smith. And that's nothing to be played with. You can literally lose your voice or do permanent damage to your vocal cords if you don't get that taken care of.
It's one of the hazards of the business that they're in, because when you have a popular song, you have to be out promoting it. And when it's popular on the charts, everybody wants you to perform it on their talk shows and in concerts and whatnot. So she probably, on average, I would guess any singer, sings a song when it's popular 3-4 times a day.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because one of my guitar heroes, James Taylor, said that Tony Bennett asked him, "Are you still doing your vocal exercises?" And he said, "No, not really." And Tony, who is now like 86 or 87 and still performing, said, no, you got to do that every day. You got to make sure you do that or you'll lose the voice.
Wow. I didn't realize that. Maybe I need to get that book.
Really? All right. Well, you know, if you have a comment about this, you can send Larry a tweet. He's at @VOA_music. Also, look for his show, Border Crossings. You can find that on our website, www.voanews.com.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, video, and pictures on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
ISIL is continuing its assault on innocent civilians with its latest kidnappings in the central Syrian province of Homs, where the terrorist group abducted an estimated 230 people, including some Christians. ISIL's attacks have also resulted in the displacement of an estimated 2,000 people from nearby villages. According to the State Department's 2014 Human Rights Report, some communities under rule by ISIL experience specialized religious taxes, or jizya, forced religious conversions, destruction of religious sites, and expulsion of minority communities. Christians make up 10% of Syria's population of more than 17 million people. In February, ISIL attacked predominantly Assyrian Christian villages in the northeast Syrian province of Hasaka, where they kidnapped dozens of civilians, including women, children, priests, and the elderly. ISIL also burned and destroyed homes and churches. Those attacks displaced an estimated 3,000 people. The fact that ISIL deliberately targets civilians further testifies to its rampant criminality and brutality against all those who disagree with its toxic beliefs. ISIL continues to exact its evil upon innocents of all faiths, and the majority of its victims have been Muslim. People of all faiths and many religious leaders throughout the region have united in condemning ISIL's depravity, its mass killings, rape, sexual enslavement, lashing, stoning, crucifixion, and public murder of hostages. The violence in Syria has killed more than 250,000 people. The United States demands an immediate and unconditional release of all civilians taken captive by ISIL. To help bring an end to these horrors, the United States remains committed to leading the global coalition to counter ISIL.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.